Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline across the top of the page, Vocational School Hung Up Over Funding. This article is written by Chris Bagley with the Dateline of Raleigh. And also, next to the picture, there's a next to the article, there's a picture of the old Coca-Cola plant. The caption reads, Former Coca-Cola plant considered for a vocational school. Plans for a 100,000-square-foot vocational school on the south side of Raleigh are in limbo as the Wake County Public School System and the county government remain deadlocked on how and whether to cover the $20 million cost. As an outgrowth of the school's career technical education program, the standalone school is envisioned as serving at least 700 full-time students or about 1,400 half-day students. But the impasse could keep it from opening for the 2014 to 2015 academic year. The initial target opening date of 2013 was abandoned several months ago. The County Board of Education approved the concept of a vocational school in April, but hasn't yet approved detailed plans or a funding mechanism, says Samia Khanna, a spokeswoman for the school system. County and school officials estimate the school's initial cost in the range of $20 million to $30 million. The school system does not have taxing authority, as do school systems in some states. A large capital project, such as the vocational school, would require funding from the county through a county bond referendum, for example. Wake County Manager David Cook says another possibility would have been for Wake Tech to negotiate the project onto a bond referendum that it's putting to voters this fall, but the college and county didn't do so. School officials have asked the county to fund the project, but Cook says the money isn't there unless the school system prioritizes the vocational school over another project. The school officials haven't done so. The school system's director of innovation, Ann DeShong, says school officials are likely to know more about the timetable after the Board of Education discusses the CTE in a closed session on September 18. She can't give specifics about the item other than to say it doesn't relate to the approval of funding. DeShong disputes the notion that the funding issue would delay the projected 2014 opening. Wake Tech's role, meanwhile, would be to provide some of the instructors for the facility rather than the financing, college spokeswoman Lori Clower says. What everybody wants to know is how important is this to everybody compared to our other capital projects, Cook says. The only way the project gets done is if the county shows up with new money. Administrators have zeroed in on the 105,000-square-foot building that once was a Coca-Cola bottling plant on South Wilmington Street, just south of I-40. Charlotte-based Coca-Cola Bottling Company Consolidated, the nation's largest independent Coca-Cola bottler, closed the facility in mid-2011 and moved its local operations to a larger facility in Clayton. The company still owns the plant and the 15.5 acres where it sits. The building and land have a total assessed value of $2.97 million, according to Wake County records. The project's cost would come mainly from buying or leasing the building and then redeveloping it. Under one possible arrangement described in a printed proposal from the school system, Raleigh-based Keystone Corporation would buy the property from Coke Consolidated and then redevelop it. Cook says the county or the school system would enter a lease-to-own agreement with Keystone. And our next article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, it's in the middle of the page. It has a black border around it. Inside that border, it has an olive background, and the top half is a picture of a man in a jacket and open collared shirt holding up a bottle and looking at it. And the caption reads, TransZymes Vipin Garg wants to see the pharma sector ecosystem fertile. And then under that, in bold black lettering, is the headline, Build and Flip. Pharma industry exec's strategy sounds much like quick real estate turnarounds. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onsorge with a Dateline of Morrisville. Aerial Biopharma CEO Moise Kairala is looking to sell the third drug company he has launched here. That's his strategy, build them, then sell them one at a time. It's what we do, he says, noting that his employees share in equity stakes and then are welcome to follow the track to the next startup. In 2009, he sold Adrenix to Osaka, Japan-based Shionogi and Company for $29 million. And earlier this year, he sold Neuronex to Ardsley, New York-based Acorda Therapeutics for $2 million. That latter sale could generate more than $100 million in additional revenue for Corellia and crew if the company's drug reaches the market. With a narcolepsy drug being developed by Aerial, now nearing Phase 2B trials, Corellia is expected to begin getting phone calls. While his companies and their intellectual property may end up elsewhere, Corellia is staying put. He says the Triangle is home both for his wife, whom he met while getting a doctorate at UNC Chapel Hill, and for his business. While exit plans are vital to his quick turnaround strategy, he wants to keep his small crew of 8 employees working in the Triangle, and so far the model is working. Corellia, whose resume includes stints at Burroughs Wellcome in Research Triangle Park and at Seattle-based biotech Citran, didn't expect the Adrenix exit but took advantage of an opportunity. That opportunity, he says, became his business model. He scouted the Aerial narcolepsy platform prior to exiting Neuronex and plans to start the search for his next drug candidate soon. While his turnover is fast, the search itself is anything but rushed. He and his team studied 40 to 50 drug candidates before deciding to buy the Aerial candidate. The key to a successful exit, his business partner Steve Butts says, is doing solid research. The Corellia Butts team only licenses products already in existence with proven mechanisms. We begin with the end in mind, Butts says. We do not undertake projects that require blazing a new regulatory pathway with the FDA. Corellia says regulatory communication is important and adds that the team communicates with the FDA early on, outlining its intent to move quickly. The next step is sticking to what the company does best, development, and outsourcing functions such as accounting and legal services. We stay small, Corellia says, noting that the core team has been with him since Adrenix, and many worked with him at Burroughs Wellcome. We have no ambitions of becoming a large organization or in building a large commercial infrastructure. Not all on the local pharma scene are happy with the idea of developing drugs and quickly selling the assets to companies outside the Triangle. It's not good for the development of the Triangle Biopharma cluster, they say. We lose some companies to attrition and others to acquisition, says TransZyme CEO Vipin Garg. And if you don't replace them at the same rate that you're losing them, the ecosystem is going to shrink. Corellia says he knows the industry and he is dedicated to his business model. Small drug development can't happen in big pharmaceutical companies, he says. When you grow, the requirements for your drug become so big that the structure starts weighing you down. The larger companies are suffering from the systems put in place. To him, drug development should be entrepreneurial, and companies, big and small, should stick to what they know. We know our strength, he says. Why risk moving outside of that? And our last article, still on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. This article runs vertically along the right side of the page. First, the headline, Long Dormant Project Poised to Finally Revive. And then under that is the article. And under the article, there's a picture, an aerial view of some land. The caption reads, Bulldozers Soon May Do Their Work on 5401 North. And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Raleigh. Patience, planning, and perseverance could finally pay off for a Louisiana real estate trust that's already more than $40 million in the hole for a North Raleigh real estate project that has yet to break ground on its first building. Baton Rouge-based Commercial Properties Realty Trust in 2007 bought more than 400 acres of pasture land and forests off Interstate 540 where it intended to develop a commercial and residential project called 5401 North. But other than a new elementary school that opened in 2008, not a tree nor a blade of grass at 5401 North has been touched. And all that's about to change. Commercial Properties has hired a road construction crew to begin work on the widening of U.S. 401 at the entrance to the North Raleigh property, and final negotiations are underway with home builder groups interested in starting the first neighborhoods in 5401 North in 2013. The site is also one of 10 contenders seeking to build an office campus for the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services that could require up to 1 million square feet of office development before 2019. All in all, it adds up to the highest level of optimism surrounding 5401 North since Raleigh city leaders approved its development plan in 2006. "We're real close," says Tina Rance with Commercial Properties. "There are a lot of things that should be coming to fruition over the next 60 days. Rance would not disclose the identity of builder groups that are negotiating to buy the first 300 home lots at 5401 North, but real estate sources say Miami-based Lennar Corporation is one of the top contenders. At build-out, 5401 North is expected to have up to 2,250 residential units among its single-family neighborhoods and apartment buildings mapped for the site. Home prices are expected to range from $165,000 to $700,000. The property also has space for 1.6 million square feet of office and retail development. Developers are even trying to convince officials with the Matthews-based Harris Teeter grocery store chain to move a planned Forestville Road store to the 5401 North site instead. A developer for Harris Teeter acquired a 38-acre site in 2006 that's about 3 miles north of the 5401 North site at the intersection of Lewisburg and Forestville Roads, but Harris Teeter officials have yet to set a date for its construction. The city of Raleigh, in late August, paid $2.1 million for 25 acres within 5401 North that is slated for a future city park, as well as an extension of the Neuse River Greenway that would connect into the North Carolina Mountain to Sea Trail system. Raleigh had already purchased an adjoining 15 acres for the Greenway Path in 2007 for $1.8 million. Wake County Public Schools has also had talks about building a middle school on the property in future phases. Wake Technical Community College's Northern Wake Campus borders the 5401 North property to the north and has been using part of the property for overflow parking for its students and faculty free of charge since the campus opened in 2008, says Lori Clowers with Wake Tech. "They've been a good neighbor even though there's been a delay," she says, adding that a parking deck slated to open in late fall should alleviate the campus's need for use of the field for parking. "We look forward to being a good neighbor," she says. "We're hoping it'll have some amenities that our students and faculty can take advantage of, like shops and restaurants." For the DHHS office building proposal, Commercial Properties has teamed with Beacon Partners' Greg Sandruder, a Raleigh real estate developer who has built multiple office buildings and multifamily properties across the Triangle region. At least six other properties in the Triangle region are also in contention for the DHHS project. Jill Lucas with the North Carolina Department of Administration, which is reviewing all the building proposals on behalf of DHHS, says no developer group nor specific site has been chosen yet. "The review is complex and ongoing, and proposals will not be made public until the process is complete," she says. But that hasn't slowed the renewal optimism for 5401 North. "If the DHS project happens, we'll be reaching our goals much quicker than anybody could have hoped for," Rance says. And now we go inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. The headline that starts it off: Gillings remarries, new bride heads California Pharma. Dennis Gillings, co-founder of the Durham-based clinical research organization Quintiles, has tied the knot. Gillings and Marielle Gingras were wed in Hawaii over the Labor Day weekend. Quintiles did not have any official comment on the nuptials and would not provide details on what spokesman Phil Bridges calls a private ceremony. Gingras is the president and CEO of San Diego-based Huya, H-U-Y-A, Bioscience International, a company that touts itself as a leader in globalizing Chinese pharmaceutical innovation. Gillings stepped down as CEO of Quintiles in April, but still chairs the board. His replacement as CEO is longtime Accenture Limited executive Tom Pike. Gillings' divorce from former wife Joan Gillings was finalized in November 2011. Chick-fil-A will be gone from the Duke University campus at the end of the academic year, but it doesn't have anything to do with controversial comments made about gay marriage by the chicken chain's CEO Dan Cathy. The West Union building, where Chick-fil-A operates an eatery, will be undergoing renovations at the end of the academic year. After that, the building will no longer host chain restaurants. Looks like Raleigh businessman Bob Luddy soon may be breaking ground for the fourth Thales Academy in Wake County, with this one to be in Rollsville. The Wake Weekly reports that the Rollsville Town Planning Board has approved a request for construction of a campus on 17 acres between Grand Rock Way and Storage Drive. The town board will hear the case later this month. Site plans call for a 55,200-square-foot, two-story building housing just fewer than 500 students in grades 6 through 12. Other Thales Academy private schools are in Wake Forest, Raleigh, and Apex. Piggybacking off its parent UNC Healthcare, Rex Healthcare has expanded its use of Passport Billing, a service by Passport Health Communications Incorporated, headquartered in Franklin, Tennessee. Using Passport helps patients understand their medical bills better before going in for a procedure, instead of dealing with stacks of confusing paperwork afterward. Also, it gives a detailed breakdown of the insurance costs and what patients will be expected to pay out of pocket. For Rex, Passport also helps with back-of-the-office billing, making transactions easier on the hospital's end. The move could result in fewer bad debt write-offs and more revenue for the hospital. Healthcare analysts argue that a clearer understanding of the bill would result in patients being more likely to pay their share. Rex Healthcare has also been named a breastfeeding-friendly business by the North Carolina Breastfeeding Coalition. The coalition gives the award to businesses that have made accommodations for breastfeeding mothers, including providing access to private rooms for breastfeeding and education about economic and health benefits. The J.D. Beam Incorporated Construction Company in Raleigh applied for a building permit in June to begin construction of the Alliance Center building, valued at $13.2 million, but vertical construction has yet to begin. Craig Davis Properties of Cary is a partner on the project. The Durham Convention and Visitors Bureau has created a new website specifically for the weekend of September 14 through 16. The site will not only allow users to see what's happening, but it will also provide access to services and information they might need to plan their Durham visit. Travel decisions are far more spontaneous than they used to be, so we're doing our best to ensure that potential visitors have access to the information they need to decide to make Durham their destination, says Sam Poley, DCVB's Director of Marketing and Communications. The September 14 through 16 events include Outdoor Arts Festival, Centerfest, the Bull City Gridiron Classic, a football showdown between Duke University and North Carolina Central University, among others. Local singing star Tift Merritt is putting on a show on September 21 in Carrboro, presented by the Town of Carrboro and the Cat's Cradle. While the show is free, vouchers have to be obtained, and the audience at the Carrboro Town Commons will be limited to 6,000 people. Also on the show are Megafawn and Mandolin Orange, according to the Chapel Hill News. At the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce's annual meeting on September 18, Chamber Board Chairman Jim Beck, President and CEO of Trust Atlantic Bank, will pass the gavel to his chair-elect, Jim Captain, the Managing Director and Site Head for Credit Suisse in Research Triangle Park. And waiting on deck behind Captain will be this year's Board Treasurer, Claude Demby, CEO of Noel Group, who will move into the chairman's post for the 2013 to 2014 fiscal year. Noel Group of Wake Forest is the parent company of plastic and foam product manufacturers Nomaco, Nomacork, and Spongex. It's been a rough year for the cattle business on the Triangle's west side, as Siler City's Clark Farms Incorporated liquidates in Chapter 7 bankruptcy. A cattle leasing business in Durham now alleges that it was wrongly milked out of $240,000 by two dairy farmers in Alamance County. James Holliday and William J. Holliday leased 140 dairy cows from DFH Leasing LLC in 2006, but the brothers allegedly stopped making the $4,000 monthly lease payments within a few months and eventually sold off the entire herd, according to a recent lawsuit by DFH. The company says it's owed $560,000 after including several loans to the brothers, accrued interest, and several other items in the lease agreement. The company says it wasn't able to sue earlier because a third partner in the Holidays farm had been in personal bankruptcy, which halts collection efforts. That partner, William E. Holiday, the Holidays' father, exited bankruptcy in April, according to court records. Meanwhile, feed dealer Ronald Charles and veterinarian Samuel Galfin also allege that the Holidays owe them money, tens of thousands of dollars. As co-plaintiffs, they and DFH sued August 27 in Wake County Superior Court. The case was transferred to North Carolina Business Court on August 29. James Holiday, whose family's farm is near Snow Camp, declined to comment. Contributing to Biz were staffers Jason DeBrun, Lauren Onsorge, Chris Bagley, and Amanda Jones-Hoyle. And now we return to our full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. The first article we come to is written by Chris Bagley with the Dateline of Raleigh. The headline, New Lawyers Finding Friendlier Job Market. The job market for attorneys has brightened a bit in recent months as Triangle area firms begin to grow again. Managers at most large firms that serve business clients say their workload has recovered to the point where they are hiring at least as many attorneys as they lose to other firms and to retirement. The Triangle's 22 largest firms collectively had about 980 attorneys as of January, up from 970 in January 2011. Mirroring companies throughout the U.S. economy, most Triangle law firms shrank from 2008 to 2011. The defense litigation firm Cranfield Sumner's Raleigh office has hired a string of new attorneys in practice areas ranging from intellectual property to general liability defense. Managing partner Dan Hartzog says, the hires have taken the firm from 57 attorneys early last year to about 63, including one recent law school grad who will be joining the firm in the next few weeks, Hartzog says. Cranville also has added a family law practice and created a new position in business development. There are some signs that the legal market is picking up in some ways, Hartzog says. We're doing a lot of things to enhance business development. I think the fact that we have grown would tend to indicate that's going well. To be sure, law firm managers say they're still noticeably short of the peaks of 2007, both in terms of revenue and in terms of headcount. The leaders of firms and in-house legal departments alike say they're still trying to discern a new normal in the profession. Meanwhile, firms and graduates are waiting to learn exactly who passed the bar exam in July. Representatives of the Triangle's four law schools, Campbell University, Duke University, North Carolina Central University, and UNC Chapel Hill, say that 340 of their graduates passed the exam and that 71 failed. But those numbers could be revised as the North Carolina Board of Law Examiners continues to unseal results that are now in question because of a power outage on one day of the exam. But the preliminary results reflect fewer graduates taking and consequently fewer passing the exam, compared to the 367 who passed in July 2011. And that could mean a tad less competition for legal jobs than in years past. Roughly half of law school grads typically go to work for law firms, while the remainder are split among corporate legal departments, nonprofit organizations, and government bodies such as prosecutors' offices and regulatory agencies. Based on the preliminary results, Campbell's 128 graduates who took the exam in July had the highest passing rate of any law school in the state, 94%. Of the 160 UNC Chapel Hill graduates taking the exam, 88% passed, while 83% of the 23 Duke graduates passed, and 60 of the 100 NCCU graduates passed. Those numbers, as with the region-wide numbers cited, include only first-time candidates. Brian Lewis, UNC Chapel Hill's Assistant Dean for Career Services, says he's confident that the school's graduates will meet or exceed previous classes' track records for joining the legal services labor force over the next few months. Most of those joining large law firms received offers months ago, he noted. The Raleigh law firm Wyrick Robbins is another with rebounding headcount, now about 67. Managing partner Jimmy Yates says, like Lewis, Yates says the firm typically makes offers for first-year attorneys while they're in their final year of law school. The two recent law grads starting at Wyrick this fall make up a fairly typical entering class, but the firm's business has been strong enough in the last couple of years for the firm to add attorneys, Yates says. And as we move down the same page in the Triangle Business Journal, our next article takes up most of the page. It has a black border around it. The top third is a picture of a woman casually dressed sitting in a lab. The caption reads, Zena Cardman is studying at UNC Chapel Hill. And then under that, in bold black lettering, is the headline, Raking in Real Dollars, NCSU, UNC, Grow Revenue Generated from Research. And then under that is the article. It's written by Jason DeBrun with a Dateline of Raleigh. The Triangle's two public research universities both recorded gains in licensing revenue this last year. NC State University generated $6.4 million during the 2011 to 2012 fiscal year. And UNC Chapel Hill took in $2.5 million. For UNC Chapel Hill, the figure is a tidy 67% bump from the previous year, when the university recorded a decline in licensing revenue from the year earlier. In NCSU's Office of Technology Transfer, Billy B. Hotelling, the office's executive director, credits a recent university-wide push in helping innovators bring products to market for the increase in revenue. He specifically touts the 10 new startups last year, up from 4 in the 2010 to 2011 school year. That number was boosted because of the Chancellor's Innovation Fund, which helps in the development, protection, and advancement of ideas and discoveries at the university. The fund will provide an invention portfolio with up to $75,000, and any royalty income from a subsequent license agreement must first go to repay funds from the CIF. To date, that fund has given financial support to 11 projects, three of which have spun out to become companies. It's notable that we are seeing startups come out of the CIF, Hotelling says. The chancellor's commitment that he made in 2010 is now paying off. In Chapel Hill, Barbara Entwistle, interim director of UNC Chapel Hill's Office of Technology Development, says she would obviously like to see the licensing revenue increase every year, but she points out that the number of disclosures increased every year since 2010, a number she highlights as important to a university's development. When professors or researchers come up with a new invention or idea, one of the first steps is disclosing that to the university. At that point, university staff members, like those in Entwistle's office, can help decide if a provisional patent application should be filed and help determine the potential for that intellectual property. At UNC Chapel Hill, disclosures increased from 125 in 2009 to 2010 to 142 in 2010 to 2011, to 161 in 2011 to 2012. What I'm seeing in the stats is that we have been moving up in a lot of ways, which has been really great, Entwistle says. The types of inventions from NCSU and UNC Chapel Hill differ in many ways. Researchers in Chapel Hill focus more in the life science fields, while those in Raleigh are more likely to file a patent in computer science or other technology. Because of that, the time to license can take longer at UNC Chapel Hill simply because of the nature of the research and license. It's a long runway in life science, Entwistle says. While it does not have an engineering college, UNC Chapel Hill does have the Eshelman School of Pharmacy, and therefore will see some intellectual property in pharmaceuticals. Entwistle says she sees her university as focused on the three Ds, those being drugs, medical devices, and diagnostics. Computer science is growing, she says, but still makes up a smaller but still important portion of the portfolio than the other three. Todd Shearer, president of the Association of University Technology Managers based in Deerfield, Illinois, boasts of the economic impact that universities have, especially at the local level, pointing out that three-quarters of startups spawned by them are headquartered in the home state of the institution. We've seen compelling evidence recently about the positive impact of university licensing activity, he says. Duke University has not publicly released its 2011 to 2012 technology transfer statistics. In 2010 to 2011, it reported $24.5 million of licensing revenue, 52 patents, and 5 startups. And we have one last article on this same page that runs vertically along the right side of the page. The headline, Raleigh wants $60 million remake of Capitol Boulevard. And then underneath the article, there's a picture. Actually, it's a map of the Capitol Boulevard area in question that we'll discuss in the article. The article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with a Dateline of Raleigh. The Foxy Lady and several other decades-old commercial buildings, motels, and parking lots along Capitol Boulevard heading into downtown Raleigh are high on city leaders' wish list for acquisition. The idea is to demolish the buildings and turn the properties into a city park with a greenway trail, a more appropriate use for the land in the watershed of Pigeon House Branch. It's all part of the city's plan to transform Capitol Boulevard, the most heavily traveled gateway into downtown Raleigh, into a showcase for multimodal transportation. The Raleigh City Council adopted the Capitol Boulevard Corridor Study Report in early August. Developed over the past 2 years, the 120-page document recommends specific capital projects, transportation improvements, and land use policies for properties lining Capitol Boulevard between the Beltline and downtown. The study estimates it will cost at least $60 million to implement the 10 roadway and infrastructure projects recommended in the report. One piece of the plan is to create a linear park and greenway trail in the Pigeon House Branch floodplain between Atlantic Avenue and Crabtree Boulevard. That half-mile stretch includes such long-standing establishments as the Miller Inn, which has been in business for 60 years, the Capitol Inn, the Foxy Lady Nightclub, and the now-shuttered AMF Capitol Lanes Bowling Center. The city purchased the Bowling Alley building in July for nearly $1.1 million from one of the heirs of former Raleigh Mayor Sebby B. Jones, with assistance from the Trust for Public Fund. Now, sources say the city and TPL are fast-tracking the process, contacting the owners of the other parcels and beginning to negotiate deals for purchase. TPL is a national nonprofit group that helps structure land transactions with willing landowners to create parks, playgrounds, and protected natural areas. The city would need to strike a deal with at least 10 different ownership groups for the 13 parcels of land between Atlantic Avenue and Crabtree Boulevard. Raleigh City Manager Russell Allen would not confirm or deny the effort. I would not be able to discuss any items related to the city's potential purchase of property until action is taken by council, he says. Bobby Poole, a Raleigh resident and commercial real estate broker who lives two blocks from the targeted corridor, says he has been advocating change in that area for years. All that area is ripe for redevelopment, Poole says. It's all substantially underutilized and could be a dynamite project. Ken Bowers, Deputy Planning Director for the city and co-author of the Capitol Boulevard Corridor Study Report, says he is unsure of the status of the city's property acquisitions, but he knows that city leaders want to move forward with the project. The long-term plan all along has been to target those properties in the floodplain, Bowers says. Maybe it will happen quicker. And now we'll turn to the A Better World page in the Triangle Business Journal. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. Nonprofit news. The Biogen IDEC Foundation and Teach for America have launched a collaboration in support of science, technology, engineering, and math, STEM, education. A $100,000 grant from the Biogen IDEC Foundation will be split evenly between Teach for America's Massachusetts and Eastern North Carolina regions. North Carolina Rail Trails, a land trust specializing in preserving railroad corridors for use as public trails and greenways, is hosting Full Steam Ahead, a benefit concert for North Carolina Rail Trails at the Art Center in Carrboro on Saturday, September 8th. All proceeds from ticket sales will help the organization create trails for public use on abandoned rail corridors. The North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, along with five nonprofit community service organizations, have received financial gifts from the Walmart Foundation, totaling $280,000 as part of Walmart's commitment to sustainability, education, health and wellness, workforce development, and preventing hunger. The museum got $50,000 designated for its outreach efforts to schools, libraries, and special populations. And now the Philanthropy News Desk column written by Todd Cohen. The headline on the column, at age 150, Ravenscroft to celebrate fundraise. And along with the column, there's a large picture of a man sitting in an archway with a tie on. The caption reads, Phil Higginson says school prepares students to thrive. In 1862, Raleigh physician Josiah Ogden Watson left a bequest of $5,000 in bonds to, quote, fund and employ a teacher of a parish school for Christ Church, Raleigh, unquote. The school opened in 1868 with 70 students, and Christ Church reestablished it in 1937 as Ravenscroft School, named for the first bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of North Carolina and the first rector of Christ Church. And in 1968, board members Robert P. Holding Jr. and his brother Louis R. Snow Holding, top executives of First Citizens Bank, offered a grant of $750,000 that challenged the school's board to match that gift within 30 days in an effort to raise funds to build a new school that eventually was located on Falls of Neuse Road. Philanthropic support has been fundamental to Ravenscroft, which now provides an education for roughly 1,200 students from preschool through high school, and this fall will kick off a year-long 150th anniversary celebration. During that celebration, the school also will be laying the groundwork for a major fundraising effort that likely will begin its quiet phase in 2013 and will support a strategic vision the school's Board of Trustees approved in 2011. That strategy calls for supporting professional development to help faculty teach more effectively in a world shaped by technology and the global marketplace, making the school more accessible for prospective students, preparing students to be leaders, and improving facilities. We're going to prepare people to thrive in an interdependent world, says Phil Higginson, assistant head of school for institutional advancement. Through a partnership with the Center for Creative Leadership in Greensboro, for example, Ravenscroft is preparing students to be leaders and engaged citizens. And in an initiative piloted last year for all 7th and 10th graders, with the pilot funded through a gift from John Riplagel, a Ravenscroft trustee and CEO and president of 7th Generation, the school this year will provide a Google Chromebook laptop for every student in grades 7 through 12. With a $13 million endowment, Ravenscroft raises more than $1 million a year, including $900,000 through its annual fund. Under a policy the school's trustees adopted about 4 years ago, 10% of dollars raised through the annual fund are designated for the endowment. The new policy has added $70,000 to $80,000 a year to the endowment and raised awareness of endowment needs, with three people creating new endowments through annual gifts, Higginson says. Ravenscroft, which in spring 2011 completed a campaign that raised $2.2 million for new entrances to its campus from Falls of Neuse Road and Newton Road, as well as a new circle, columns, and trees on campus, will spend its anniversary year celebrating its philanthropic legacy. The anniversary celebration will include an anniversary book that will be unveiled September 27 at kickoff event at the North Carolina Museum of History, and a gala next spring. Our passion now, Higginson says, is making certain our faculty are given the tools they need through professional development to really be able to provide the finest educational experience. And now in the People on the Move section, the Wake Tech Foundation named Nathan Becker, a project manager at ABB, Joan P.H. Myers of Applied Research Associates, and Kent Thompson, a wealth management advisor at Financial Directions Group Incorporated, to its board of directors. The Wake Tech Foundation board also named the following to its leadership team: Jill Wells Heath, chair; Ed Turlington, chair-elect; Larry Hamilton, treasurer, and Stephen Scott, secretary. The Wake Tech Foundation's mission is to partner with corporations, foundations, and individuals to support Wake Technical Community College's institutional and instructional needs. The Raleigh chapter of the National Christian Foundation named Natalie Taylor director of Giver Services in its Raleigh office. Grid firms on growth trajectory. That's the headline of our next article. This one's written by Chris Bagley with a Dateline of Raleigh. Demand from overseas, particularly from the developing world, is helping to fuel growth among companies in and around the Triangle that make software and high-tech gear for managing utility grids and for managing utility use. Raleigh, Cary, and Research Triangle Park host several dozen such smart grid and smart meter companies, including the smart meter manufacturer, Sensus USA Incorporated, regional headquarters of the international giants, ABB Limited, and Elster Group SE, and numerous smaller companies. The companies are hiring locally at a collective annual pace of about 600 people. Several are helping to form a trade group, the Research Triangle Clean Tech Cluster, with an expected annual budget of at least $250,000. While none of the companies release revenue figures that are specific to North Carolina or the Triangle, data from a state agency and interviews with company representatives and outside analysts suggest that business is growing more swiftly overseas than in the United States for many of the companies. That's because Brazil, Mexico, and other developing economies are installing electrical infrastructure from the ground up, people in the industry say. While the U.S. also represents a fertile market, utilities here and in other developed countries upgrade transmission and distribution gear mainly when installing new types of generating capacity and when old gear ages out and, less notably, to accommodate economic growth. They build everything from scratch using the latest technology, ABB's Bill Rowe says of developing countries. ABB's North American headquarters in Cary coordinates contracts in Mexico and the Caribbean, where growth is particularly strong, and in the U.S. and Canada. The company employs about 350 people in Cary, about 250 at its facilities on NC State University's Centennial Campus in Raleigh, and more than 250 at a manufacturing facility just south of Rocky Mount. In early August, ABB announced a deal to supply Brazil with $55 million in electrical transmission gear for offshore wind farms. In mid-August, Elster reported a deal to supply 110,000 water meters to the South American nation. While neither contract is being handled primarily by the company's North American division, Morningstar analyst Daniel Holland says the company's international reach helps them win contracts around the world. Wind and solar farms are among the most important drivers of demand for smart grid development, Holland says. They inherently require a smarter grid system just so you can account for the intermittent nature of generation, he says. North Carolina companies exported $1.24 billion in electrical equipment and appliances in 2011, up 19.5% from 2008, according to the State Commerce Department. The state's total exports rose just 7.5% to $27 billion. Those figures don't include revenue from software subscriptions and other services, which are also major components of the nascent smart grid industry. Software providers include Caribase SAS Institute and Power Analytics, whose offices are in San Diego and Northeast Raleigh. Power Analytics Director of Product Management, John Jennings, says international sales have come to account for more than half of the revenue his company derives from the most basic software for managing microgrids at universities, military bases, and large factories. It's not chump change, Jennings says. There are definitely a lot of opportunities out there. And our next article is written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dateline of Raleigh. The headline, Changes in Works for Students as College Debts Mount Up. Organizations have worked to keep default rate in North Carolina lower than nations. And along with this article, there's a picture on the UNC Chapel Hill campus, a long line of students. The caption reads, Students queue up near the old well at UNC in Chapel Hill. As North Carolina's college students finish their first weeks back in school, they may also be acutely aware that they are deeper in debt than ever. The pool of student loan debts has deepened substantially from an estimated $1.34 billion during the 2010 to 2011 school year. This school year is the second since the U.S. Department of Education took over the program that lends directly to the nation's students. Now, even more changes are in the works. The Raleigh-based College Foundation of North Carolina, for decades the most widely recognized college loan servicer in the state, will sign on with the feds in February as a contractor. It will begin administering student loans both in and outside of North Carolina. Meanwhile, the North Carolina State Educational Assistance Authority, the state agency that once financed those loans through bond sales, is out of that business. Its erstwhile primary role now in federal hands. NCEAA continues to administer various grant programs. It also runs North Carolina's so-called 529 program, named for a section of the Internal Revenue Code that encourages families to save for college education. The CFNC NCEAA duo has helped keep North Carolina's loan default rates to less than one-third of the national average, 2.7% versus 8.8% nationally. Supporters have attributed that success to the two agencies' relationships with their borrowers and their willingness to negotiate repayment options. But observers wonder whether that strong record will continue with the two institutions' roles so dramatically altered. Our agency will not be involved in the prevention of defaults, NSEAA Director Steve Brooks writes in an email. With CFNC administering a national sample of loans instead of concentrating on North Carolina, I expect that the default rates will be higher than in our North Carolina program over time, but I hope not. He says, borrowers defaulting on student loans faced a host of consequences, from bad credit scores to garnishment of wages and tax refunds. Student loans are also relatively difficult to discharge in personal bankruptcy. The Department of Education took over the student loan industry after the financial crisis froze many of the credit markets that were crucial for groups like the NCEAA. Some 53% of college students in North Carolina have loans. Borrowing averages $21,000 for those students. Nationally, 66% of college students have loans, borrowing an average amount of nearly $26,000. At North Carolina State University, just 47% of students have loans, with an average amount of $18,126, according to Lewis Carson, the university's Associate Director of Planning. Student loan officials at UNC Chapel Hill didn't respond to a request for information. Heather Jarvis, a Duke University law graduate and Wilmington resident who advises former students on loan repayment, says the U.S. Department of Education has done a good job of getting cash to students who apply for it. Still, she says, the student loan authorities should be proactive in making borrowers aware of the range of repayment options that exist. That could help to keep North Carolina students' default rate low, she says. As long as the information gets out to people, there's no reason why anyone should default, she adds. A bigger challenge, she says, is to help borrowers structure their repayment plans. And our next article in the Triangle Business Journal has this headline: Senator blames state board for damages. And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Raleigh. And there's two pictures. There's a headshot of State Senator Neil Hunt inside this article. And then also there's a larger picture of his home. The caption reads, State Senator Neil Hunt claims damage to his home was due to violent shaking. State Senator Neil Hunt, a prominent real estate investor, is blaming the North Carolina Licensing Board for general contractors and a construction firm that it hired after his North Raleigh home was damaged during construction of the agency's new headquarters nearby. The North Carolina Licensing Board for General Contractors, the state agency responsible for policing professional construction contractors, has claimed no fault. Hunt and his wife are crying foul in a lawsuit filed in Wake County Superior Court in early August. Violent shaking at the construction site next to their 34-year-old home off of Creedmoor Road has damaged the home's foundation and forced cracks along its walls, floors, and doors, they allege. My wife called me hysterical, saying the house was falling apart, Hunt says. We complained and told them to stop, 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 and they did. Then they put vibration equipment out there after they were done, so of course nothing registered on the equipment. The licensing board had hired Raleigh construction firm R.N. Rouse and Company in 2009 to build a $4 million, 20,000-square-foot office building at 5400 Creedmoor Road that would serve as the new headquarters for the state agency. The property abuts the Hunt residence on Sherbourne Place in Raleigh, and the licensing board moved its staff into the new building in 2010. Hunt, a Wake County Republican, is a four-term senator currently running for re-election and president of Hunt Management Company in Raleigh, a real estate management and investment firm. Before stepping into public office, Hunt was involved in the development of more than 4,000 multifamily units and single-family homes across the Southeast, but he and his wife, Dudden Hunt, have lived since 1978 in the same house where they raised their two children, now grown. In 2008, the Hunt's backyard neighbor sold 2.7 acres along Creedmoor Road to the licensing board, and in October 2009, the Hunts were notified that the licensing board's contractor had discovered some bad soil on the neighboring headquarters property. The soil would need to be compacted with heavy equipment, they were told. Dudden Hunt recounts in the lawsuit complaint that she heard a loud roar coming from the licensing board's headquarters site a couple of weeks later. Her home began to shake violently. Glasses in the kitchen cabinet rattled. Furniture throughout the house shook. Pictures and art on the walls moved and shook, the lawsuit alleges. The Hunts allege that they soon began to notice visible damage to the interior of the nearly 3,000-square-foot house. Mark Self, the secretary treasurer and top executive of the licensing board, says he's been instructed to not comment about the case. And here we have a short article in the Spotlight Banking section of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Banks Getting Healthier on Basis of Lowered Net Losses, says FDIC report. Around the Triangle, with so many community banks and a handful of big banks fighting for every deposit, this report from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation could not have come at a better time. The FDIC says only 10.9% of FDIC-insured banks had net losses during the second quarter, down from 15.7% a year earlier. Also, the number of problem institutions fell from 772 to 732 during the quarter. The average return on assets for the entire group of banks increased to 0.99% from 0.85% a year ago. For giant financial institutions such as Bank of America, Wells Fargo & Company, and J.P. Morgan Chase & Company, that's additional money that could be rolled over in loans. And these banks may finally have started doing just that. The FDIC report states loan balances rose by $102 billion during the quarter, most of it going to the commercial and industrial borrowers. This quarter's return to loan growth is an encouraging development, but we will have to wait and see if the trend toward increased lending can be sustained, acting FDIC Chairman Martin Grunberg said. And for our remaining minutes, we turn to the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here's some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Novant still locked out of Wake. Novant Health has had its hopes of entering the Wake County health market shot down again, but will likely appeal to the North Carolina Court of Appeals. A September 4 ruling by Drexdell Pratt, the director of the Division of Health Service Regulation in the Department of Health and Human Services, upheld an earlier denial of Novant's application to build a 50-bed hospital in Holly Springs. The North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services regulates the number of hospital beds in the state, and on September 27, granted a combined 101 acute care hospital beds to WakeMed Health and Hospitals and Rex Healthcare. Lenovo pays $148 million for a Brazilian firm. Chinese PC giant Lenovo Group is buying Brazilian consumer electronics maker CCE. The $148 million deal will help Lenovo nearly double its share of the PC market in the world's sixth largest economy, Reuters reports. The purchase will allow Lenovo to add mobile phones and televisions to its product line in Brazil. Duke, progress among best in Echo Devo. Site Selection magazine has named both Duke Energy Corporation and Progress Energy Incorporated, which recently merged with Duke, as being among the nation's 10 best utility companies in terms of fostering economic development. The magazine considered a range of factors in choosing the 10 from among the 200-plus utility companies in the United States. One was the volume and nature of corporate expansions in and moves into the various utilities' service territories, processes that require extensive cooperation from the utilities. It also considered utilities' programs for promoting energy efficiency and renewable energy, tools and data on the utilities' websites, and input from corporate managers who select new sites. Most of the information for selecting the top 10 came from 2011, before Duke and Progress merged. FDA again delays ruling on Salix drug. In a somewhat unexpected decision, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, for the second time, has delayed a ruling on a drug at the heart of a dispute involving Raleigh's largest homegrown drug manufacturer. Those involved were still trying to figure out the ramifications of the delay and adjusted their sights to the first quarter of 2013, when a new ruling is now expected. Salix Pharmaceutical, trading on the NASDAQ under SLXP, headquartered off Six Forks Road in North Raleigh, licensed the drug crofelemer from San Francisco-based Napo Pharmaceuticals in 2008 and filed a new drug application for that drug on December 14, 2011. Red Hat Amphitheater for downtown Raleigh. The name Red Hat is becoming even more integrated with downtown Raleigh, with the software company now buying the rights to put its name on what has been the Raleigh Amphitheater. Red Hat will pay $235,000 a year for a total of $1.175 million over the five-year term of the deal. That's less than the $1.5 million Bud Light was willing to pay for the rights until the state ABC Commission rejected the beer company's proposal. The deal means the open-air concert venue, which opened in June 2010, will be called the Red Hat Amphitheater. The 6,000-seat venue is a, quote, perfect match for this uniquely Raleigh company, Red Hat, unquote, Mayor Nancy McFarland says. And we'll stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can reach us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.